Manoli Girmanchev, thank you very much for speaking with SBS for the second time for your second publication, and it's titled An Aussie in a Parallel Universe, and it follows your life after the first publication titled My Childhood Memories, From a Shepherd to a Chemical Engineer.
Well, thank you for inviting me to come here, Margarita. It's been about 4 years since I wrote that book,
yes.
And now I wrote the second one. You know why I wrote the book? By the way, because really, you made a comment when you downloaded something about me, and you said, oh, Manoli Girmanchev, in his first book, he wrote such and such. And then I started thinking, maybe she's probably trying to say that I could write another book. That's one reason. Another reason is that my son actually read the book, and he said, gee, Dad, I'm glad you wrote it. You told us your story about in Macedonia. That's a part that we didn't know. But then I thought to myself, there's another part that you don't know. The part that since I came to Australia when I was 12 years old, till the time you were born, my son,
yes.
A lot of things happened. Jobs, meeting your mother, and so on. So I thought, yes, I should say that as well, you know.
Yes, it's a great reference for children and for grandchildren.
Yeah.
But why do you think we miss so much? We miss telling our children so much about our life.
I think it's a busy time, busy life. We don't live in the same houses. They come for a visit, and the visit is almost orchestrated. You haven't got time to sort of start telling your thing. But now I had this opportunity to tell them that. Also, about writing the the book, in the first book I mentioned the phrase that when I came from Macedonia, it was such a contrast between the village that I was born and Richmond, a tiny little suburb, packed with houses. We lived on open fields, and the houses were scattered all over the place. And this place looked like a different universe. That's why I call it parallel universe. And then I left that phrase there, and I said, I'll leave that for some other time, for another story. And now is the time to write another story. So I wrote the second book.
Yes, well, I can see you've answered my first
question. Yeah, saw some of those comments there. And also about the teaching. I mean, I still meet my teaching friends, and they all say, you know, remember such and such thing we did at school? Wasn't that amazing? Wouldn't it be good if somebody writes a book about it?
Yes.
So there you are. So I included it in the book. This book is a patchwork of stories.
Yes.
And in one of those patchworks, I talked about schools. And in there, I said some of the funny things that went on between students and teachers, and also between teachers and teachers. It's more about the funny things that happened at schools.
Well, I guess you've captured moments from the collective memories of your students, your colleagues, and your own.
Well, I think I've got an amazing memory also. Mm-hmm. It's almost like going back and visiting your past and reliving what we did. Sometimes I can just imagine myself being there and talking to the person. And I enjoyed actually writing the book. As you know, I'm not selling the book. The book is not for sale. It's open to anybody to read. So I'm not making money out of it. I'll be happy if people read it, especially our community, the Macedonian community.
Yes. Well, Victor Bevel, Politikon Publications, has published your second book as well as your first, and it's available on their website, isn't it?
That's right. And
get a great insight into your life, both in Macedonia and in Australia.
Yeah. Well, look, if anybody wants to read it, all they have to do is either Google An Aussie in a Parallel Universe or Google my name, but the English name, like Ollie Germanzis.
Yes.
If they do, they'll get me there.
Now, the book begins with some really vivid descriptions of your childhood in Macedonia, your family's agricultural lifestyle and the hardships caused by the Greek Civil War, which ultimately led your father to migrate to Australia. Now, Manoli, you reflect on your family's move to Richmond, where you were struck by the stark contrast, which you mentioned just before, between the rural Macedonian landscape and the industrialised Australian suburb. What was life like growing up there?
Well, look, I didn't know any better. I was born after the Civil War. I just heard stories about atrocities and people suffering, but I didn't suffer that. I just enjoy the environment. I love winter. I love the snow. We had snow on the ground for maybe about 3 months of the year, and I just walk, even barefooted on the snow. When you see fresh snow, just that it fell that night and nobody else stepped on it. It's just a beautiful sight. So as a child, I enjoyed it. We had quite a few animals, probably around about 5 acres of land, and on it we had a bush, an orchard. We grew our own watermelons, rock melons, plenty of things. Our house was bordered by a clear water creek, and I remember sliding. There's a big sliding rock there, sliding in summer, not only in summer, but in winter. And the creek was full of ice. And we'd just try and slide down without breaking the ice.
Yes, because that's part of the little ride you have on slippery ice.
Yeah. In the first book, I mentioned that we were given shoes by the Dunlop Company from the aid companies, you know, because we're desperate people. And I used to wear those shoes out in summer so they become slippery so I could use them in winter as skis. So going back to your question, as a child, I thought I was in heaven.
Well, you describe your life as being in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, it was. If you don't know anything better, Margarita, that's what it is.
And you've got some wonderful descriptions there, Manoli. Autumn is the best season of the year, mainly because that's when our land rewards us for our hard work. The corn cobs are peeled and laid bare on the natural slate in our backyard. The grapes have been picked and crushed, and then the wine is made. The delicate farm produce is sorted. Different fruit, cucumbers, green tomatoes. And then you also mention that wealthy families in Germany will savour the exotic Mediterranean fruit in exchange for a few dollars. So it's wonderful.
We're a decent strawberry patch, and we collected enough strawberries and we used to export them to Germany. This chap with his refrigerated van would come along and take a...
So that was just like a direct export...
Direct export to Germany. That's what said. Those people were happy to get something from us, because I don't think strawberries grow in Germany. It's too cold up there and climate's not right for them. And the money that we used to get for that, we would buy things that we couldn't grow or couldn't make ourselves.
Yes.
For example, we didn't buy toys, we didn't buy anything like that. We just bought kerosene for a lamp so we can have light at night. I bought rice. Mm. Rice doesn't grow in that part of Macedonia. Simple things, simple life and enjoyable.
There's a lot of how you lived in Macedonia in the first book, isn't there?
That's right. That part that you just mentioned before, just the introduction to my second book, just to tell you where it came from. And then most of the second book, the Aussie in the Parallel Universe, describe how I tried to fit into this community, into the Australian way of life.
Well, yes. In one of the chapters, you talk about learning the meaning of the word mate, and then you met some Sheilas.
Sheilas, that's right. I thought I'd better start up with a very good chapter just to attract the Australian audience, the word mate. It was fascinating because Dad took me probably 2 or 3 days into Australia. He took me down to this little market that's in Richmond, in a street, and everybody started saying, "Hey, go, mate. Hello, mate. How are you, mate? You buy something. Thank you, mate. See you later, mate." And, of course, I had to ask Dad, what is this word, mate? First time I heard it. He reckons it means friend. I said, "Oh, you got friends, Dad?" "Well, no, reckons, not really, reckons. When somebody doesn't know your name, they call you mate." I said, "Oh." And then I understood because at that time, Dad had his Greek name, and was Konstantinos. And can you imagine any Aussie living in Richmond back in 1962 or 63 that who can pronounce the word Konstantinos? Nobody. So Dad changed his name to Jim. So he got an Aussie name, Jim. The Konstantinos is a Greek name, and in Macedonian we call him Mitre. So poor Dad had about 4 names, Konstantinos, Jim, Mitre, and Mate. That was the most popular name.
It was the easiest one that was shared.
That was the easiest. I mean, I even use that name. If I meet someone and forget his name, I just call him mate. Here you go, mate.
What was your experience like, Manoli, in school as a young immigrant?
Before I went to school, I really had a different experience because we came around about March the 9th or 12th, I think it was, and school had already started.
That's
and
right.
Dad, unfortunately, he thought school finishes like it does in Europe in July. So he said, "Wait till July, then you start a new year." So from March to July, I stayed home. I'd sit in the little house that we had and up at the door. It was a hot day. March is still very hot. And I'd stay there and count cars. That's why I got a chapter in the book, Counting Cars. And I was counting cars because it was very interesting cars. So I wanted to find out which is the most popular car, which is the best car, and so on. So I was counting cars. While I was counting cars, this girl came along and sat next to me. I said, "Well, that was my first experience. I didn't know one word of English. She could have said something, but I didn't understand." So we stood there looking at each other. She wanted to touch me, that sort of thing. She went closer and closer. I moved away. So in the book, I said, we started this conversation of you move, I move, you move, I move, until I eventually got off the chair and left. So that was my introduction to Sheilas in Australia.
You spent years searching for the true blue Aussie. What did you learn about Australian identity during your journey?
What did I learn about him? It's different, it's varied, and it's not real. There's no such thing as real Aussie. As I said, the first Aussie that I thought was real turned out to be Dutch. Next Aussie that I thought is real, he had freckles, he was suntanned, he was a surfer, he turned out to be Scottish. And another chap turned out to be British across from England.
How did your Macedonian heritage influence your perspective on Australian culture?
Oh, that's a very sophisticated question. Basically, nobody knew Macedonia then. Initially, they say, oh, you're Greek. Oh, yeah. And then I remember explaining to them, no, we're not Greek. He said, what difference does it make? Here we are. I'm Victorian, and then other people are like Queenslanders. We're all Australian. I said, no, it's not like that in Greece. We've got a different language, different culture. We've been suppressed by the Turkish community before that, and then after that by the Greek community. So it's not exactly like a New Zealander being different to a Victorian or New South Wales. Anyway, bit by bit, you sort of educate the Australian community. So my quest was sort of to point these things out to them, you know. And it is amazing. We are a very small minority, both in Greece and in here, and hardly anybody knows us. All of a sudden, they confuse us as Greeks. And, of course, we get a Greek name. Our names have been changed to Greek, so anybody sees my name, it's Greek. They assume. In Australia, I found out people assume things about you according to your appearance and according to the way you speak, you know, to your accent and so on. So all of a sudden, a lot of people confuse me as either Greek or Italian. Hardly anybody can say for sure that I'm a Macedonian.
Did that ever present any problems for you?
Does it present problems at all? It makes it more interesting. It's sort of, I feel like I'm educating people. And as I found out later, I spent about 36 years as a teacher, so it looks like I like educating people.
But just on that then, what led you to pursue a career in teaching after working in engineering?
Again, it's got to do with our lifestyle. Now, remember I said we had 6 months of snow in a village? During that time, we spent that at home with family. Now, in addition to that, of course, my father was in Australia, but I had extended family. My grandfather was there, my grandmother, my mother was there, a few aunties, and there was a whole family around the house. And I thought, I was married then, and I said, when I have children, I want to share this same experience. I want to be with my family, with my kids. In engineering, we only had 2 weeks of holidays.
Wow, that's a lot of time.
2 weeks were given us, and that was around about Christmas. I said, what we do when the kids have school holidays, you know, in March, July, later on in September, they have 3 lots of holidays. I said, I'd like to be with them. So what I did, I wanted to become a lecturer because lecturers do have holidays, and I enrolled to do a PhD in chemical engineering. And I started the course. I was working at RMIT at the time, but still as an engineer, not a lecturer. They gave me half a day off, plus at night. And I worked out that it will take me 7 years to finish the PhD. By that time, I'd become a lecturer and then spend time with children. I said, by that time, the children would be grown. So the best thing to do, go into teaching. This is back in 1974. So in 1974, the D1 teachers, they were looking for teachers. It was easy to get in, so I got into teaching, thinking falsely that in about 5 or 6 years' time, when the kids have grown up and they're going into secondary school, I'd go back into engineering. Wow, big shock for me. By that time, there's a huge change in engineering. Everything went digital. Everything went computer. And I was out of it.
What year are we talking about?
We're talking from 1974 to about 1980. That's where the computers come in. Remember the computer called Commodore 64? Remember the floppy disks?
Floppy disks, all these things?
Yeah, they kept on advancing at a fantastic rate, and I didn't keep up because I was at school. The school teachers thought they were keeping up, but it's nothing to what engineers were doing. Yeah, big gap. When I was working at DSL as an engineer with cars, we used to go and punch the cars and actually program our own computer. After that, they got this tape, and you can write things down and learn a bit of computer programming. But then with teaching, it all fell apart for me, and I missed out. I remember applying for a job, and the chap said, do you know how to run such and such program? I said, I never heard of it. I'm willing to learn it. He said, no, we want you straight away. Get on and get on with it when we've got time. And some of the programs that are used in engineering will take you 3 or 4 months to learn it. So I was basically shut out from engineering because of my not keeping up with the computer development. Yes. Isn't it amazing?
Do you regret that?
I don't regret that because there's different aspects in teaching that are just as enjoyable. In fact, different kids, different nationalities, different teachers. I was allowed courage to do programs, you know, activities. And you mentioned before that we made this solar-powered cars, I was in hybrid cars. We did a lot of mechanical or technical things at those schools. I did enjoy it, yeah.
In the book, An Aussie in a Parallel Universe, you describe innovative projects like building fuel-efficient cars and organising ski trips. How did these activities shape your teaching philosophy?
I sort of think that if you want to teach somebody, you have to make something. You have to see something work. It's no good just describing something in a book. It's no good just listening to someone say, this is how it works. It is much better if you see something working. I remember in one school, I've got an old car. I've got a classic car where you can take it apart. You can take the bonnet apart and you can see the carburetors. You can see the exhaust system. You can see the distributor. You can even see the rocker cover and see moving parts. And I took that to school one day when I was doing junior science, something to do with physics. And I said to the kids, come and see how a car works. I said, see that there? That valve there, up is up. Air goes in there. A bit of petrol goes in, explodes. It goes out through the exhaust pipe. The kids were fascinated. They wanted to know more. I was very popular at school. They come up to me when I was doing yard duty, and they'll ask me questions about cars. Which cars are better? V8s are better? 6-cylinder cars are better? Or a flat 4 is better? You know, questions about cars.
You must have inspired a lot of productive thinking.
Look, I've got a feeling for these kids who do trade subjects, who use their hands. I worked in both technical schools and in high schools. High schools teachers look down at tech schools and at tech school students. They say, oh, are they only good with their hands? I said, no, my boy. They are good with their hands because they've got a brain that controls those hands. If kids are good with their hands, they are brilliant with their brains. There's my quote, if you want to write it down.
You completely turned that way of thinking, didn't you?
Yeah.
So what challenges did you face as a teacher, especially in multicultural schools?
I didn't find too many challenges. For a start, look, I was well qualified because I knew both physics, chemistry, mathematics. Not many teachers know all those three subjects. Teachers who started to be teachers, they do a Bachelor of Education with a method called either maths or science, but not do all three. So I was a needed person at schools, and I enjoyed teaching. For most of the time, I taught physics all the time and senior mathematics, coupled with junior science, things like astronomy, sometimes biology, but basically I stood around with technical subjects all the time. In high schools, I don't push those subjects. And now they're finding out, my reader, that we need tradesmen, we need technicians, we need engineers, and say, oh, come and do the STEM program. STEM meaning science, technology, engineering, maths, you know. It's sort of the circle that made a complete loop. We need technicians, we need technologists.
Well, Manoli, you've got an exceptionally strong background in these subjects because you were also part of the Defence Forces in Australia.
Yes, true. I enjoy that work too. It was very interesting work. And I worked during the time when Australia was in the in Vietnam, and we're developing weapons and ammunition and systems for the Vietnam War. I mean, one of the things I did with my chemical background is actually we developed a tracer bullet that can stand up to humid conditions. The tracer bullets that were made before, they'll turn off, they'll switch off. They wouldn't work in Vietnam because of the humidity. So we had to develop new ones. and I was involved with that. I remember firing thousands of bullets through these boxes and watching them and changing the composition of the chemicals until we got them right, until we got 99.9% success.
And I remember you describing one point in time when you were working on the development of a particular form of ammunition, that because of the secrecy involved, there were separate teams set up all around Australia. Can you remind us about that?
It was a cluster bomb. Okay, now the cluster bomb is actually banned. It's a dangerous weapon. It has maimed many innocent people. But there are still countries who use them, you know, rogue countries that do use them. But Australia did develop its own cluster weapon. I think it was used in Vietnam. And the reason it was built in three different places so that no single person would know the whole process so they could make it. My process was to actually develop the nose of the bomb to open up and let the little bomblets come out, and also the fuse in the bomblets. So and it was... If we finished it, we developed it, and it worked well. But I'm not very proud of the work. It is funny because at the same time, I was against the Vietnam War, and I tried to get out of the conscription. So I joined the CMF. If you were a member of the CMF before it was time for you to register for the army, you can just stay with the CMF and not go to Vietnam. You know?
Now, the CMF is...
CMF stands for Citizens Military Forces. And I spent 6 years in that. It's a part-time, say, activity. You do it part-time. And at the same time, I was working at Defence Studies Laboratories. They were very good for me because they paid me, and the army paid me as well. There is a chapter in this book about the national conscription. I call it the cut lunch soldier because the CMF people were not regarded as real soldiers because they used to bring the cut lunch with them. Because we did about, for 6 years, we did 2 weeks continuous, and we had to serve about 10 weekends away. And every Thursday, I remember going for 2 hours every Thursday night for theoretical work. So it's sort of not real, not being a real soldier, but they did train us how to do the basic training. I made fun of it in the chapter because I wasn't really interested in being a soldier. I just behaved like I didn't know what was going on. And I just enjoyed picking on all the sergeants. There are some funny episodes about the sergeants coming up and yell at me and so on. And I say, oh, I pretend that I didn't know anything. It is amazing.
Okay. Manoli, your book touches on prejudice and cultural misunderstandings. How did you navigate these challenges in your personal and professional life?
Well, I'll tell you what, I never experienced any bullying. I did experience some prejudice, which means when I was asking for promotion or when I was being interviewed for jobs, before I got this job at DSL, I was interviewed many jobs and I was rejected all the time, you know. And what happens there, people say, okay, this bloke, I'll give him an interview, but we won't give him the job. I sort of felt that, you know. And they don't actually tell you that. I just say, you're unsuccessful. No, they tell you in the face, they say, oh, you're unsuccessful. I go, why was I unsuccessful? At DSL, after I perfected this tracer bullet and some other marker, we're marking the territory of Vietnam, so they are, aeroplanes could drop food to our soldiers, and I devise a method which can show them where they are, and then that method will just disappear so nobody else could see it. They were impressed with the work they did, and there was a opening for me to get promoted, and I applied for that. It was just ideal for my job. It was pyrotechnics, and that's what I was doing, pyrotechnics. And then this other lady got the job. She was a chemist. And I said, how did she get the job? Oh, because poor lady, she's been here for 30 years. She's never been promoted. It's time we promoted her. And the blank interviewed me. He said, look, we want you. We can open a special department for you. You can do the work, but she'll have to pay the higher level. At that moment, I decided to leave. A bit of racial prejudice, if you like. People laugh at me, the way I pronounce things, but not offensive. I sort of enjoy it. So I thought I'd leave. And funnily enough, I found a job. It was Wednesday. I looked at The Age, and there they advertised jobs in The Age at the time.
Yes.
I found a job at RMIT.
Looking back, how do you feel about your journey of living in two parallel universes? What message do you hope readers take away from your book?
Well, I tell you what, there are a lot of people who do live in parallel universe. I'd say almost everybody lives in their own little universe. Okay, they got their own little way of thinking. They go along with other people, but no, I don't want to do that. Really, everybody is an individual, and everybody lives their own way, and you can call that being a parallel universe. Now, you know, I like physics, and it's not to do with the real universe, you know. There's no two universes. You know, so this is just how you feel. I enjoy it, and I can swap over from being an Aussie to being an Australian. And most of the time when I was growing up and going to uni, well, it's college, it's uni now, it's RMIT, so it's like a university. I went to both Swinburne and RMIT. I was one of the first of my generation to go into a tertiary course, and my parents didn't know what was going on. So, oh, what are you studying? I used to go snow skiing and go surfing. So you're doing all these Aussie things. Like you're turning into an Aussie, you know. I said, no, you know. It's like I'm taking the best of both worlds sort of thing. So I still stuck around with my Macedonian community. I could get on with people. I could discuss things with people my generation. And, in fact, I did visit the Macedonia senior community in Templestowe somewhere, and then they still do the little oro. The ladies dance around, the men go and play the cards,
yes.
And then others discuss, oh, this is what happened at war, this is what happened, this is what we did. They still do the memory. And what I discovered from then, Margarita, is that a lot of people that generation, they've been traumatized by the Civil War, and they still keep the trauma with them. They're very reluctant to let it out in case it damages people. I don't know what it is. For example, my father never spoke to me about the war, what he suffered. He was injured in the war. He was in the Partizani, and he didn't like it. He escaped from the Partizani. Then he went and joined the Greek army, the opposition, if you like. He fought for both sides. And also, he's got a cousin in Sale. They both passed away. But when I used to take him to Sale, they go into a 2 or 3 hour long conversation about what they did as partizani. But with me, they wouldn't talk. It was almost every Thursday, the teacher tried to encourage us. You know, it's very difficult for a teacher to teach English in a technical school. Kids don't want to read. They don't want to do history. I was a student, and the teacher was trying to teach us English at a difficult time. So you'd get us to read about 1 or 2 pages at a time.
That's right.
2 pages at a time. And he kept on asking us to read the same book. Well, at that time, I was working on news agency. I delivered newspapers in the morning, and I'd bring a... Now, this is true. People won't believe what I say, but I'd bring a comic, and I'd put a comic in the book, and I'd read the comic. And the teacher came around, and he saw me. He saw that I was reading the comic, and I think kind of how he understood, and he let me continue my comic. Isn't it amazing?
Well, it takes...
I like little real things like that. So the book is not a novel. It's not going to make people excited. But another cousin of mine, she read the book within a day, and she reckons, really, the tiny little details that you put in, a lot of people don't put them in. And that's what really makes life interesting. The little episodes, the little comments you had with a person, the little, I don't know, practical joke that you played and how the kid reacted. Or they are the little moments that create your life.
I guess that's the difference between one teacher and another. You've been very popular as a teacher.
Yeah.
You must have learnt from some of those examples how you were approached by teachers. Did that have an influence on you, how you then approached your students?
That did happen, actually. One other student at Richmond Tech. Now, Richmond Tech was a fantastic school. It catered for trade people. It did not discriminate against anybody who wanted to do academics. You could become a doctor if you wanted to be, a lawyer. All you have to do is just study. They catered for almost everybody. But most of the kids actually did trade subjects. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, we need them, especially now.
Yeah, yeah. Also, they gave us a lot of responsibility. I was a prefect in year 11, and at that time I was 18 years old, because I remember coming back from Greece. I lost 2 years of schooling, and I had a car. I had a little Volkswagen Beetle. Now, our prefect master, he was also my science teacher, he had this huge car. It was a Pontiac something, a Pontiac, big American car.
Yes.
And the car couldn't go around in Richmond lines and so on. Now, you say, this has got to do with going around in Richmond lines. Well, some kids would abscond to school. They come in the morning, tell the parents, I'm going to school. They stay for about period 1, period 2. When it comes lunchtime, they run away.
They'd had enough.
They'll walk around Richmond streets until around about 3 or 4 o'clock so they can go home and tell the parents, I've been to school. Now, the prefect master asked me, if I guess we better go and get those kids back. So he said, can we use your car? So there I was, driving around Richmond, picking up kids who were absconding school. And I know some of those kids now, and some of the kids are very successful. They came at an awkward age to school. They probably came at the age of 15, 16. They were too old to go into primary school.
Were they migrants?
They were migrants. I mean, Macedonians. They're from our village.
Right,
they're from Nered, Lagan, all those sort of villages.
I see.
My brother-in-law came up at the wrong age, too big, too grown up to go to primary school, so he couldn't learn to speak English. When you go into a secondary school, whether it's technical school, teachers expect you to at least know another language. And then they go into the curriculum and start teaching either mathematics or history or whatever they do, and they expect you to know that. Well, our kids could do that. And then they'll run away. And we had to go get it back.
You were collecting your compatriots.
I was collecting my compatriots. I was doing a service for them. It is fascinating that the teachers would trust me to do that. And another thing that we did with my car again, I chose the sport of ice skating.
Yes.
And the school offered ice skating, but the ice skating was in St Kilda, St Marie's Ice Skating Rink.
That's,
in St Kilda.
I remember it.
You remember that?
Yes.
Okay. I used to do speed skating. Three other kids. The only way we can go there is in my car. So three kids and me, four, and we had to have a teacher. I would take the teacher to the sport, to supervise us.
So four of you in the Beetle.
Four kids and the teacher. At that time, it was the era of the miniskirts. And these teachers wearing miniskirt were just, excited to take this teacher down to St Kilda in a miniskirt. He was fun just joking around. But now those sort of, relationship with students and teachers don't exist. You need a police check. You need a certificate of safety. You need, a lot of things.
Right, you need clearance.
You need clearance. So you get the idea, Margarita, that this is a book of funny things, awkward things, or strange things. It's not about physics. It's not about parallel universe. And there's a fair bit about teaching, but it's not about education. It's more about relationships between people, between students, teachers, and other things.
Well, I think we can say quite safely that it's more of a memoir, isn't it?
One bloke who read it was my son-in-law, actually. He said, there's no story to it, Ollie. I said, no, it's a collection of stories, really. A collection of short, small stories.
So, looking back over the two books that you've written, in other words, your life, a lot hasn't been included in your two books. Do you think Australia has changed in terms of multiculturalism since you first arrived?
Oh, yeah. Australia, when I first came here, Australia was under the White Australian Policy. And the White Australian Policy was sort of discontinued or wiped out in 1974. You know, I come back in 1960, so 40 years I had to put up with it. During that time, the administrators of school, whether the principals or the vice principals, they're quite oldish. They were set in that era. Everything still runs under the White Australia Policy. So when it was abolished, they didn't change. They still kept their own way of thinking. So there was still some sort of a discrimination, you call it, comparing people to other people and so on. So, and it's really funny. I found now that the schools who actually promote thinking and accepting people and so on, they are the most racist areas. especially schools in suburbs, in north-eastern suburbs. It is amazing. They don't think so because they think this is the way. But when you compare it to western suburbs, when you compare it to inner suburbs, larger population of migrants, they do stand out as favouring the Anglo-Saxon society. It's noticeable, really.
What was the most rewarding part of writing your memoir?
The connection that I got with my grandchildren. As an example, my grandchildren want to go back to Macedonia with me and retrace the route that I took from Lerin, Solon, Athens, Piraeus, because I described that in a fair bit of detail,
yes,
you know, in the first books, so on. And it's amazing how they look at me as a person of wisdom or person of mystique.
Yes.
And my granddaughter says, my dad is an author now, as well as being an engineer, teacher, now I'm an author. Wow. And before that, I was a social worker as well. I worked as a social worker for about 8 years for Berry Street, Victoria. I inspired this girl to study engineering, of all things, and she did. Probably the only girl that graduated from university that went through the Berry Street School.
Yes.
Now, if you don't know, Berry Street School caters for kids who are really, really down. They've got parents who don't look after them. They are on drugs. They are violent. And they've been kicked out of every school. They are not allowed to go to any other normal school. That's the only school that will take them. And that school only started about 2002 or something, about 20 years ago. And I was one of the original people who helped start it. I did the technical parts of it. I set up a woodwork shop there, a welder shop, and another chap set up a motor mechanic. Principal's husband, who's a history teacher and a musician, he set up a music room.
Yes.
And we established a little school called Private School. It's an independent school that caters for these kids who are banned from going to mainstream schools.
You gave them a place to come to be educated.
Yeah, and also an opportunity to move in back into society.
Yes.
That's the only girl that actually got a degree. Most of the kids ended up being chefs, working for McDonald's, getting jobs in as gardeners. We also had a cooking department. I can mention here my friend Liz Sorensen. She was very, very good with it.
You're right. Your book is full of entertaining anecdotes and thoughtful observations. An Aussie in a Parallel Universe, Manoli captures the immigrant experience, the blending of cultures, and the importance of inspiring future generations. And you could say it's a celebration of resilience, multiculturalism, and the journey of finding one's place in a new world. You obviously found your place.
I have. You seem to put them in nice words. I just put them in straight. I call a spade, or you know, sort of thing. I'll tell you another thing that I did at this. I taught at 5 different technical schools, and one of the hardest technical school to teach with was Northwood Tech.
What was it, boys' school?
It was all boys' school, poor family background. I remember people were offering excursions and so on, and some kids who couldn't afford to go to an excursion. And that revoked memories of me because I couldn't afford to go to excursion. We're very poor. Our family is very poor. Then I decided to take some kids there on an excursion. And I asked the teacher, the principal, who happened to be a migrant, by the way, from Italian background, and he understood. He said, can you give me a list of poor families who can't afford to go on this excursion? Because excursions were costing money.
Yes.
And there were kids who just couldn't afford even $20, whatever it was. I said, I'll give him a free excursion. And I started building a whole of the house. I had a whole of the house half finished in Mount Beauty. So I said, I'll take him up there with another teacher, and we chose 7 students because we went in a private cars. I could put in 3 kids in my car. It was a 2-door sports car, and the other bloke can take 4 kids, you know. So here we are in our private cars. We took the kids there. We cooked for them. We took them to Bogan Village. We took them to Mount Buffalo for a drive. We cooked lamb chops for them at our expense, the other teacher too. I remember kids saying, this is the first time I had steak.
Goodness. That is very, very sad. Yes, very, very sad. It's so unfortunate, and I think it's always been something that has not quite sat right about this country, hasn't it? A lot of people have said that in this country we shouldn't have poverty.
It's true, but another thing that I constantly discuss with another friend of mine who we taught at a different school is that not all schools are uniform. One school a year is different to, as I said before, the eastern suburbs,
yes,
the western
yes.
suburbs,
more
the northern
affluent,
suburbs.
Yes.
And they also vary from year to year depending what teachers are there. Some teachers will leave after 5 or 6 years, they'll leave. So for a particular period, a particular school can be excellent. And maybe 10 years later, it's different. Different teachers come. This is where I suppose private schools have got the advantage because they kept on recruiting teachers the same ideas, the same ethos and same behaviours and so on. But state schools, other schools, open to whoever comes in. And sometimes you get a brilliant teacher, sometimes you get a teacher who's interested in a particular topic. It's always different. Another little aspect, this is again when I was a student at Richmond Tech, beautiful school. I used to actually work every now and then. On a sunny day, I'd go down to Killer Beach for a swim. One day I remember coming back on the tram around about 3:30 or 4 o'clock, and all of a sudden the tram stopped near a private school. I think it was either Melbourne High or Melbourne Grammar or something.
Grammar, yes.
And this bunch of kids came in with their striped tops, red and black, three sizes bigger, because that's what parents at private schools do. They buy a thing that will last for the whole 6 years. But about 5 or 6 of those kids stood in a group, and they started reciting Pythagoras' theorem. Can you believe it? I said, for a right-angled triangle.
That's how they remembered them.
Yeah.
Their formulas.
The square or the Pythagoras is equal to the sum of the squares of the other two sides. And that's how they learn. And that's how they teach him, if I was good. They taught him Pythagoras' theorem. Now, next day, I assume, because really the teacher must have said, we're going to have a test on Pythagoras' theorem tomorrow. And then I'll learn it. And the teacher will say, okay, recite Pythagoras' theorem. And they say exactly the same.
Yes.
For a right angle triangle. But then if you ask those kids, use Pythagoras' theorem to calculate the sloping side of this triangle, they'll say to you, we didn't do that at school. But our kids at technical schools, they did it. If they couldn't work out the mathematical side, we'll teach them to draw it to scale, measure it, and use ratios, magnify it, do something.
So you're saying there were differences?
Oh, huge differences. Kids in special schools, they learn by rote. They practice. They don't know how to use it. I remember I've got another friend. We're still friends. He runs a car business. And one day he wanted to convert from, the fuel consumption of cars. It used to be miles per gallon.
Yes.
Now they give it to you in litres per 100 kilometres. That's sort of reversed. And he wanted that converted. So he asked one of his nieces, who had finished year 12 with very high marks in mathematics. And she goes, oh, gee, Uncle, we didn't do that in class. I think that says everything about how different schools teach things.
Can you explain it?
What was wrong?
Yes.
I think the teachers at high schools have never themselves been out and worked. They learn these things from a book, and then when they go back into teaching, they teach it from a book. They don't teach practical examples. They don't teach where things are taught and they can be used. I remember I enjoyed teaching similar triangles. Now, similar triangles are triangles that's got the same shape, same angles, but different in size.
Yes.
I used to tell this kid, okay, let's go and use similar triangles to work out the height of this building. Put it to use. So and the kids listen to you. So they come out, so stand there, see the shadow the building's making. You stand where your shadow meets that shadow. Measure your shadow. Measure the shadow of the building. See, the shadow of the building is 3 times bigger than your shadow, isn't it? Yeah. How tall are you? I'm 1.5 metres. Oh, so that means the building will be 3 times taller than you, because that's the ratio. So the building is 4.5 metres. They got it. Practical thing. They saw it. And I said, don't even stop there. Don't believe this thing. This is just a theorem. Why don't you now count the bricks, measure each brick, and work out from the bricks their height is. And they do count it because they like it. They do something that they can grasp. It's tactile. They can see it. They can do it.
Yes.
I did it, and I worked out. And, of course, I got the measurement pretty close the same, of course. And that's the sort of thing that I enjoy showing kids.
Well, what other examples do you have of providing real examples to your students? I can imagine there must have been hundreds.
Hundreds of them, but, okay, going back in the book, I've got a diagram there. I showed you that shows that a moving object, moving horizontal, and another object come vertically, they go down towards the Earth, towards the centre of the Earth, at the same rate. Now, there's a very good description there how to build a model, how to build a thing, use it, and prove to yourself that that theory works. And that theory comes, it's not my idea, it comes from, again, when I was a kid, I used to run home to watch the science show by Julius Sumner Miller. He would show experiments about physics, physical concepts, and he would demonstrate them and so on. And I was fascinated when he demonstrated that concept, and he actually made an apparatus. And I made the same apparatus at home before when I was writing this book to see if it works, and it does work. And if someone's got a bit of technical, can use his hands, understanding, or if he doesn't quite get it, he can ask someone else. And I ask him to actually do it so they can get the satisfaction of what engineers do or what physicists study instead of just reading it from a book.
That seems to be part of the foundation of teaching, doesn't it? Showing the students real examples.
Well, even in our teaching methods, when we went to teachers' college, they say if you tell someone, you sort of remember for a few minutes. If you ask him to write it down, you'll remember for a few hours. If you ask him to make it and see it working, you'll remember forever.
Good philosophy.
And that's why I sort of went into making these energy cars, the solar-powered cars. Kids can actually see them, make them, take them. I remember it was a very hot day once, and I told them if we wanted to have a chance at winning this competition, I think we should cool this solar panel down. And we brought a towel, with a wet towel put over there. So why are you cooling it down, sir? I said, because the efficiency of a solar panel increases with temperature. The colder it is, the more efficient it is. I said, the poor solar panel's going to do two things, conduct heat and conduct electricity. If you take the heat away, it will conduct more electricity. So, yes, if you keep your solar panels cool, they are more efficient.
Ah.
But then you say, oh, in winter they are less efficient. Well, it's not because they're not because of temperature, but in winter the sun is less powerful. So basically, if you can put your air conditioner on your solar panels in summer, they'll work a little bit better.
Yes. So what are your thoughts on renewable energy?
My thoughts are it's good, it's cheap, it's there, it's free, we should use it. But till now, petrol has been very cheap. It's been abundant. It's much more powerful. I remember I was involved with these solar-powered cars that come from Darwin to Adelaide, where the universities compete, and they are solely powered by solar. And for a little car to run on solar, it needs about 2 square meters of a panel.
Right.
And those 2 square meters would probably develop about 1 or 2 kilowatts of power. Now, people with V8s and petrols, they drive cars that have got 800 kilowatts.
Wow.
You won't get a person driving a poor little solar-powered car that just got 1 or 2 kilowatts of power, just accelerates very slowly. The wind will blow it. No. The mentality is not there, okay? We've been spoiled by cars that run on petrol. I mean, alternative energy, solar energy, wind energy, they're all there. In my opinion, they do affect the environment. Because if you cover the earth with solar panels, then you're doing something to the soil. You're stopping the soil from growing grass, for example. A lot of people say, oh, put them in the ocean. Well, if you cover the ocean, then you stop evaporation, and then you interfere with the rainfall. So basically all those things, one thing interferes with another thing. So basically we need a balance. Something that people have never, ever thought of, and they don't do it, they don't think of reducing. How about if we lose less energy? Would it be better? What about if we lower our heater down to 20 degrees instead of 35 in winter and in summer air conditioners, instead of getting down to 16 degrees, how about we just put them down to 21? Or how about if we don't have air conditioners at all? How about if we just plant trees? Trees absorb the heat.
Yes.
Trees are air conditioners. Trees are solar panels. They absorb the heat and they turn into carbon. There's a lot of things you can do, but one thing people don't reduce the use of energy. And I am really annoyed with the size of cars that people drive now. And they use a huge amount of energy. Cars weigh about 2.5 ton. My original car, the VW, weighed about 800 kilograms, like 4 times less.
Than a normal car, a standard car?
I'm talking about Ford Ranger, these utes, you know, twin cab utes. And that's what people are choosing to buy now. Big cars that weigh a ton, 2 tons.
Believing that they need it. Isn't that the typical car for a tradie?
Yes, but tradies need it, but there's more of those cars than there are tradies. I'm trying to restrain myself, Margarita.
I'm noticing. Well?
I think your last question is, am I likely to write another book?
Yes. I've just seen it.
Well, I tell you what, before I wrote this second book, the An Aussie in a Peril Universe, I got in touch with my publisher, Victor, and I asked him, Victor, you think it's a good idea to write another book? He said, yes, it's always a good idea to write another book. And I think Victor was impressed with my first book, and he likes this book. So, yes, I'd say there's something stirring in the back of my mind to write another book, but it won't be what you think. It won't be about other teaching. It won't be about the Macedonian community. It will be about money. I'm thinking about money.
Money. So money. You're going to get a bit financial.
Financial, not even financial, but from the point of view, what money does to your psyche. How do you feel about if you're rich? How do you feel about poor? Why do people unnecessarily spend money? How much happier they are if they got more money? Is it a direct relationship? The more money you got, the happier you are. There's a limit to where you say, that's enough, don't compete. It'll be an interesting thing, but I haven't thought it out in my mind of how to present it.
Well, you've got plenty of time to consider that.
Well, I'm getting older, Margarita. Remember, the last book was 4 years ago, a little bit younger, 72, I think. Now I'm about 77.
Well, you're still going strong, Manoli, and you've done a brilliant job with both books, bringing all of your insights and your thoughtful observations to the reading public. And I thank you very much for celebrating your life with the rest of us.
Well, thank you for listening to me, and I hoped, you know, your listeners would actually read my book.
Yes,
free.
I'm sure they will.
Free, isn't it good?
Absolutely. That's that. Well, speaking of money,
yeah,
there's no need for it.
Exactly. Okay.
Have we covered everything?
Well, of course we covered everything.
I mean,
it's not an exam.